Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Charles Simich, the author most recently of Night Picnic, a book of poems published by Harcourt. He is the author, of course, of many books of poetry, from Dismantling the Silence and Return to a Place Lit by a Glass of Milk, to the recent Jack Straw's Walking the Black Cat, A Wedding in Hell. He has written critical essays, many of which have been appearing in the New York Review of Books and have been collected in books from the University of Michigan Press. He is the author as well of a really beautiful, subjective explanation, examination, analysis of the work of Joseph Cornell. He's one of my favorite American poets, although I want to talk to him in part about immigrant poetry here. When I started reading you, it was, as I've in fact told you before, the object poems, the poems about the fork and the knife, and they formed very beautiful air balloons in my mind, and I saw them at the time as hermetic poems. As time has gone by, and the poems have been filled with dark alleys and bloodied streets and figures of horror, I have become aware that the poetry really is a response to the century, that it is not a purely internalized poetry. You've written an essay recently about the poetry of Miwosh, and you comment at the beginning that you can imagine a future in which American poetry is described thusly. They wrote as if history had little to do with them. And as I've thought about it, it seems to me that your recent work, perhaps all of your work, is washed by the events of history.
Yes.
It's the detritus left behind by the
terrorists. Yes, very, very much. You're right. I mean, my obsession, my lifelong obsession, because of my background, has been history, 20th century history, past centuries history, with its horrors and its the way it affected millions and millions of people in various ways. And after about three or four books, I mean, that begins to really be the underlying subject in so many of the poems.
Now, many of the poems in the new book, Night Picnic, by my guest Charles Simich, are concerned with the sense of a world that continues despite the fact that horror is creeping under it, so that one can still have a picnic even in the night. And I began to see that sense of what you have been calling immigrant poetry or immigrant fiction. You mention it in reference to Saul Bellow and, of course, in the case of Miwosh, as being that sense of coming to an America full of picnics, ballroom dancing in strangely preserved halls, but somehow a broken rule at the bottom.
I would not make such a radical division between the American reality and this other, you know, European reality, because here too, I mean, awful things have happened here too. I mean, I'm thinking about the civil rights movement, labor movement. I mean, this whole country too has a history. Nevertheless, what it doesn't have until very recently, of course, September 11th, is kind of horrendous destruction. And to see your cities and villages reduced to rubble, is really an incredible sight. And then the other additional, 20th century experiences that so many people had of civil wars, which are one of the, we had one in 19th century, but we've forgotten about that. Well, this was all happening intensely elsewhere. There is a feeling in the United States, especially in American poetry, that world of history is elsewhere.
Let's hear a poem.
Well, I'll read a poem which addresses that subject, in a sense. Sunday Papers. The butchery of the innocent never stops. That's about all we can ever be sure of, love. Even more sure than the roast you are bringing out of the oven. It's Sunday. The congregation files slowly out of the church across the street. A good many carry Bibles in their hands. It's the vague desire for truth and the mighty fear of it that makes them turn up despite the glorious spring weather. In the hallway, the old mutt just now had the honesty to growl at his own image in the mirror before lumbering off to the kitchen where the lamb roast sat in your outstretched hands smelling of garlic and rosemary.
I thought I would ask you to read what could be a companion poem because it ends with an image from the newspaper, and that's "We All Have Our Hunches."
We all have our hunches. The child turning from his mother's breast with a frightened look to watch his grandfather raise a beer and drink to his future happiness. In the kitchen full of unwashed plates and busy women with quarrelsome voices, the oldest of whom wields a rolled newspaper with the smiling president's picture already speckled by the blood of warm weather flies and mosquitoes.
Charles Simich reading from his newest book, Night Picnic. Now, when I came to the end of that poem, I really recoiled with a sense of shock because, what I imagined was the newspaper. I thought of the smiling president as being President Kennedy. Of course, it could be any president. But as soon as you use the newspaper for what it becomes eventually in the summer, a fly swatter, it becomes almost a fortune teller's prediction as the bug's blood bloodies the face of a politician of what we would be facing or what we might face. And it's often that sense of shock that alters your poetry from a poetry of what would be depression to a poetry of uneasiness, of terror, of unpleasant excitement. It interests me how little, in fact, your poetry is interested in depression, and always, in fact, it's almost an alertness, a mobilization that it demands.
Yes, because, I think while, something awful is happening, something else not so awful is continuing, going on. one of the earliest realizations that I had was that life just doesn't stop because bombs are falling or because they're taking out someone to be shot. During the Second World War in Yugoslavia, they would shoot hostages. If something happened to a German soldier, they would, gather hostages, go out and execute them. But life continued. If I may tell a little story, I remember during this bombing, we were bombed in 1945 in the spring by the Allies who were bombing Germans who were on the ground in Belgrade, English and Americans. And we were in a cellar. This was downtown Belgrade, a four-story apartment building, and we were down in the cellar cowering because it's the noise of bombs falling is a noise that one just doesn't encounter anywhere else. It's scary. You hear them whistling, and then there's a sort of a guttural from the bowels of the earth, a rumble, which one doesn't forget. Well, in the midst of this, this neighbor, this woman says, you know, where is my son? She had a son who was, I mean, I was then 6 years old, and he must have been about 11, and he was missing. So some guys went up to look for her son, who was just next to her side, you know, a moment before, and found him. He had walked upstairs and gone through the front door of the building and stood in on the street watching the bombs fall. So they drag him in, bring him in, I should say, semi. And his mother, delighted to see him, instantly started slapping him around, saying, I'm going to kill you. If you do this again, I'm going to kill you. Now, meanwhile, while this is all going on, bombs continue to fall. It isn't that they stopped the air raid because of this. And I remember, all I remember is being more scared of her slaps, the way she was slapping that kid around, than of, for the moment, of the bombs. I mean, I have endless sort of, you know, memories of that sort, of this sort of simultaneous realities that, that go on. And it seemed to me always a betrayal of some fundamental aspect of human existence to just have the dark, you know, the depressing, the pessimistic image, story, point, because there's always life continues even in worse places. So.
I'm speaking to Charles Simich, the author most recently of Night Picnic, a book of poems published by Harkert. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I was once talking to James Tate, and he said to me with great merriment and affection that one of the most constant debates among young poets that he teaches is how old you were and what year it was when you came to America. Will you say?
Well, I mean, I was 16. I came in 1954. I left Yugoslavia in 1953 and then spent a year in Paris. There was some... well, there were a number of places, anthologies, that I mean, I have absolutely no idea how... would report, you know, the arrival date 1949, 1951, 1948, because I wrote a memoir and I, you know, I gave the exact dates. It isn't that I, you know, hit it, but anytime your life gets a little complicated, you realize how, I mean, how many errors occur, you know, as people try to summarize your story, your life story.
But I think it's significant because I think that no matter... I can't say, for instance, when my grandparents came to America. And I can hypothesize from the stories my grandmother told me. She lived to be 101. But at different times, she would remember things from her girlhood. She would remember things that her own grandmother told her. And I think it's true that when you make a change of cultures, memory is not affected by the date, and you can remember things whether you're in Russia or New York City, whether you're in Czechoslovakia or in New Hampshire.
Sure.
And so, you know, the past becomes a very fragile, very plasmic kind of thing.
Also, you know, just as you're saying this, I mean, I remember how much this is reinforced when you come to this country, because in the beginning, the first, you know, few years, your parents especially, I mean, you spend your time as immigrants. And what do immigrants talk about except what your grandmother talked about? So this kind of... most of my great immigrant stories I heard when I came to this country, because you know, people would tell you their story.
Now, you mentioned that one of the great virtues of immigrant literature is that it can bring another kind of voice, another kind of language, but in particular, another kind of humor into the literature.
Yes.
And I wondered about that in particular.
Well, I mean, that's... I think humor is part of that experience. I mean, if I mean, again, coming back to my early days in New York, I mean, the book was, I mean, crucial. I didn't realize it at the time. But, you know, you knew, Jews, Italians, you knew Russians, I mean, you knew all sorts of, you know, Eastern Europeans, Hungarians. And these stories were told, endlessly. There would be new stories, more incredible adventures from somebody's life. But they were always accompanied with a great deal of laughter. I mean, it isn't that we sat around, you know, crying. No, we laughed. I mean, you would hear the most horrendous story about someone, being in a camp someplace in impossible, you know, life situation, and the turns of the story would be so amusing occasionally and absurd that everybody would laugh. And I think there's something very healthy about that laughter, because it just transcends everything, all evil. I mean, it's a laughter that transcends the horrors. And I think I try to keep some of that in my poems.
Well, there's a particular cackle in this new book that I would love for people to hear. This is Charles Simich reading the final poem in Night Picnic, The Cackle.
The Cackle. We our world, insoluble world. You may as well be a goldfish swimming in a bowl of ink, for all we understand of you. Your small beer philosopher, tin horn preacher, chronic bellyacher is about to die laughing tonight with one final cackle at the sight of a young couple slinking into the doorway of a grand old funeral home right across the street for some hut you know what.
Charles Simich reading The Cackle. I love that poem. What comes as a big surprise, I guess, the goldfish swimming in a bowl of ink seems almost like a classical surrealist image, or as we were speaking before with Edward Hirsch, an image of Duane Day. Mm-hmm. The bright gold and the blackness of the ink. And then you end in such a different spot. It's almost as if these poems are there to remind you that even though we may think of the fish in ink as an Eastern European kind of poetry image, hot you know what ends up, you know, around the corner from us.
Sure. I mean, when I was writing a poem, I mean, I remember thinking, like, you know, the universe is basically a surrealist proposition. But realism, because I also believe in realism, I mean, the hardcore realism is to be found right here. We live in a framework of realism. There's a funeral home, and this is something I, you know, saw many, many years ago in New York. And there's this young couple who are going to make out their, you know, smooch in the doorway of a funeral home. Terrific, no problem. On the other hand, here is the infinite universe, and everything we think we know about it, and that's it's more surreal than in the world in which we live. So for me, always. These two aesthetics, realism versus surrealism, which seem contradictory, struck me really as being part of the one and the same world. It's just which way you turn. If you turn to the left, it's surrealism. To the right, it's realism.
Last time we spoke, you thrilled me by saying something that I had never thought of, and that you said that you had never thought of before either, that the poems, in their way, had the greatest resemblance to the chess problems you worked on when you were a child.
Oh, yes, I remember that, yeah.
What I thought about after that was, yes, these poems, if they begin in the dismal world, they must be reminded of the human world, even if it's just a bumblebee.
Right.
If they begin, in a sense, in Europe with a European image, they must end in America with a bit of slang. And so the poems are like doing a chess problem in that always it's about trying to escape from a trap while creating another trap. In a way, the poems are always escaping from one world to another. Their job is to get, well...
I like that. No, that sounds very, very much what, you know, one hopes to do. I mean, like any metaphor, one cannot, you know, extend it too far. I mean, I guess the difference between that approach and, say, someone who is in into some idea of self-expression, articulating, you know, recreating their experience. Poets who think in those terms, they give the impression that they want to just simply sort of pour out what sort of lies on their hearts. In my case, the primary allegiance is to the poem on the page, which is, after all, it's a work of art, the way a chess problem is.
Well, also a work of art. Well, you see, what I think is that it's like an escape from a prison. And once the metaphor escapes from a prison to the other side,
sure,
right, it realizes that the whole world is a prison.
Right.
You're still caught.
Or you could say another way. I mean, it would be ridiculous for me to simply stop with experiences of World War II, because, I mean, I have lived most of my life in this country. I mean, so that reality, too, with its endless little events, needs to be included.
I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned self-expression and another kind of poetry, and you'll forgive me for being absolutely shocked. There's a poem in the book that suddenly addresses a Mrs. Simich.
Oh, yeah.
I wondered if you would read it for us.
I should say something about this poem. You know, I live in the countryside and have New Hampshire in a very small village surrounded by woods. I mean, miles and miles and miles of forest and all sorts of creatures live in those woods. So, I mean, this is the context. I mean, I've been there since 1973. I climbed a tree to make sure. A working slaughterhouse prettied up by the evening sunlight is what I think of your meadows and hills, Mrs. Simich. What about the woods in the back where your cats vanish and one hears short, blood-curdling shrieks at night, or worse, one hears nothing but the wind gusting in the dry leaves like a baby rattle shaken by an undertaker. Every butcher needs an assistant, the sun skewered in a tree told me. By now, I could smell your chimney smoke, and before long, there you were, stirring the heavy pot on the stove, turning around to wink at me.
I think that's a wonderful poem. So frightening.
Well, it's just, you know, there's a kind of tongue-in-cheek address to people who idealize nature. I mean, it's hard to take a walk in the woods of New Hampshire without thinking of the Transcendentalists. I mean, every tree where I live is known Emerson and Thoreau, you know. And sometimes there's so much killing out there. You know, that, I mean, all you see is carcasses, you know. I was just struck with, this is a slaughterhouse. This is really awful what goes on out there. And so everything else follows from that. perception.
I keep thinking of that phrase that became inadvertently hilarious by overuse, that Tennyson phrase, nature red in tooth and claw.
Yeah, of course, it is, indeed. It's just terrible some nights, what sounds one hears from the woods.
I thought I'd ask you to read one last poem.
Sure.
This is Charles Simich reading from Night Picnic.
This really has some relationship to an experience. It's a Mexican poem, Mexico City. Mexico City, I mean, you have so many beggars, you have so many, little acts on the streets. I mean, street life is just absolutely teeming, intense. This is a little scene. Drawing a blank. A bamboo cage on the sidewalk. Two clairvoyant canaries, Panchito and Estrella. I was advised to choose between very carefully. So I picked her to draw a card with my fortune. A card that came up blank on both sides to the cheers of the onlookers and the dismay of the street astrologer who hurried to offer me another draw free of charge, making a big fuss while I held on to the blank one as the crowd swept me along into the world of streets and piazzas, that ferris wheel of a day and late into the night, winding down by myself in a cafe whose walls were antique mirrors, where a decrepit, white-haired inebriate who introduced himself as a doctor of philosophy pondered its significance, while I stole peeks at our reflections, dim by the smoke of our cigars, except for the card lying on the table, still unmarked under his dropped ashes.
You know, that poem reminded me of a famous line in a movie, but it should be a Charles Simich line. Marlene Dietrich is looking at Orson Welles in Touch of Evil. She's reading her tarot cards. She's laid out the deck for him. She looks down and she says, "Your future is all used up." I've been talking with Charles Simich, author most recently of Night Picnic, published by Harkett. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Michael.
You can read the first poems of Night Picnic on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Mouse Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.